Case 22-5421, Eric Tarter versus Metro Nashville Airport Authority et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes. Mr. Goldman, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is David Goldman, and I am the attorney for the appellant Eric Tarter. Your Honors, at this time, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. One day in August, Mr. Tarter, in Nashville from Pennsylvania for a wedding, attempted to rent a car from Hertz rental counter at the Nashville International Airport. However, on that day, he did not leave with a Hertz rental car in tow. Instead, he left with bruised wrists and a lesson, an up-close and personal lesson in unconstitutional policing from Officer Brian Robbins, Officer Jerry Lovell, and Sergeant Dalton Engstrom, the appellees. On that day, even though the officers did not have probable cause to arrest him, even though he was unarmed, even though he made no attempt to flee, and even though he was calm and cooperative for more than 40 minutes, the officers handcuffed Mr. Tarter for nearly 30 minutes while they investigated him for a fraud crime that he was innocent of. The district court granted summary judgment in favor of the appellees, and in doing so, they held that the appellees did not violate Mr. Tarter's clearly established rights.
Do we have to find that it was effectively an arrest? The cases seem to talk about that, but or that it's kind of unreasonable under Terry. Are they the same thing, or are they different?
Your Honor, I believe the cases hold that handcuffs ripen a Terry stop into an arrest unless there are specific facts that are present that would give rise to a reasonable belief that a suspect poses a flight or risk of violence. So in the absence of those factors, the use of handcuffs in a Terry stop, which is an unfavored action, ripens that Terry stop into an arrest. And so in the absence of probable cause and the absence of any specific factors.
They've admitted there's no probable cause, right? So there couldn't have been a valid arrest. So the only reason we're here, I suppose, is does this fall under the situation where there's a legitimate reason to handcuff him even though he's not under arrest?
Exactly, Your Honor. And if there is no legitimate reason, it ripens into an unconstitutional arrest.
Okay, and then does the duration matter? Is the duration a secondary claim? Like, in other words, yes, maybe you could have put him under arrest for 5 minutes to figure out whether he was in fact committing fraud, but once that's cleansed, 25 minutes is out.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that any use of handcuffs for any amount of time when there's no legitimate purpose is an unconstitutional, ripens into an unconstitutional Fourth Amendment seizure.
What did they find? They couldn't tell whether he had a valid driver's license, and also he had several incidents of some sort of a fraud with credit cards or something like that?
That's correct, Your Honor. The reason why the investigation lasted so long is because it was a Saturday and the Pennsylvania DMV was not responding to the officer's requests to verify his identification. So for 45 minutes, they're waiting for the Pennsylvania DMV to come back with verification of his driver's license. In that time, they're investigating other credit cards in his wallet. They're investigating his background. And 45 minutes into the investigation, in which there's video of this, he is standing calm and cooperative for the entire time. And in fact, sometimes the officers turn their backs to him. 45 minutes into the investigation, they handcuff him after allegedly receiving the background report indicating that he had previous arrests. Now, but there's no argument, there's no dispute that did not ripen into probable cause to arrest him. There's no evidence. In fact,
saying this is an arrest. What, when they put the handcuffs on?
Yes, because there was nothing that Mr. Tarter did to indicate that he was a risk of flight or violence, and that is the law in the circuit. In Brown versus Lewis, this court held that there need to be specific facts giving rise to a reasonable belief that a suspect poses a risk of flight or violence.
So both two of the officers testify that in their experience, you know, fraud suspects or whatever, you know, flee or whatever, right? So they put, I mean, it's not super specific, but that's what they say in these declarations, right? Why doesn't that make it a situation where, I mean, they do, and they're in a crowded area, okay, if they're in an airport, right? So why is that not distinguished, the situation from the other, from Bennett and Brown?
That's a good question, Your Honor. One, there is a, there's actually a dispute of fact whether the officers knew that fraud suspects have a tendency to flee. These declarations were introduced in summary judgment, and we objected to them because they conflicted with the officer's prior deposition testimony. Well, in any event, they raised a factual dispute about whether what they knew at the time. Not, it doesn't make, so that the fact that fraud suspects may flee when approached is a fact that is technically in dispute. We disputed that.
Is that a fact, though? Is that something, they're testifying to what they believe to be true based on their experience. And I understand that this is an objective test, and we say it's an objective test, but we have plenty of cases that say officer experience is relevant, which to me makes it a little bit subjective, right? Because every officer's experience is going to be different. So this officer says, look, in my experience, and this may not be true of any other officer on the force, but in my experience, when we confront these fraud, people suspected of fraud, and it's the, you know, hey, look, we got you dead to rights, they run away. Why is that not enough for them just to put the handcuffs on him at that point?
Well, Your Honor, for in this instance, Mr. Tartar did not flee. He stood there for 45 minutes, calm and cooperative. There was no indication that he was going to flee. Secondly, I think the case law makes it clear that the focus is on the actions of the detainees themselves that poses a risk of flight or violence. In every case in which this court has held that the use of handcuffs is constitutional during a Terry stop, the suspect themselves at that time did something to warrant the use of handcuffs because it gave rise to a reasonable belief that they may flee. Now, Your Honor.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I thought that it was relevant what they were suspected of doing. In other words, it's like Graham, that if you are suspected of being a violent criminal or a felon or whatever it is, that might justify the use of handcuffs, whereas if you're just suspected of fraud, you wouldn't be. Is that right?
So, Your Honor, there are cases from this circuit that hold that if a detainee is suspected of a violent crime, a crime associated with the use of weapons, that it is reasonable to believe that they pose a risk of violence. But every time this court has endorsed the use of handcuffs specifically because a detainee poses a risk of flight, it has been the actions of the focus on the actions of the detainee themselves. And in this case, it is undisputed that he took no action that would indicate that he was a flight risk. In Bennett, this court said the suspects did not attempt to flee or do anything else, to take any other action to warrant the use of handcuffs. And so here, a generalized hypothetical risk that...
We don't really have a case that talks about if I have this... I mean, it seems to me that implicit in these cases about violent people suspected of violent felonies is the suspicion that they might flee, given the seriousness of what they're accused of, right? So if I testify that in my experience, people that are accused of fraud like this tend to flee when confronted with the evidence, that puts it, even though it's not violent, why doesn't that put it into that box? And not the, I understand that you didn't actually try to flee, but why am I not in the box of people that are suspected, or we just draw a line and say you were one of these people that might flee?
Well, what is undisputed in the record is that that there was a memorandum presented to the officers that said that fraud suspects tend to flee when approached. And the remedy there is to bring multiple officers, not handcuff them. So, and that's what happened in this instance. The appellees approached in triplicate and confronted the Mr. Tartar with the suspected investigation for fraud. He did not flee, and therefore, so that's what we're talking about when we're talking about the evidence that prior experience lends a belief that fraud suspects might flee.
There's not really any evidence that the two declarants, that email exists, right? And this guy Walters is on the email, right? But he's no longer a defendant.
He was never a defendant, Your Honor.
Okay, never a defendant. although he's the one that told them to handcuff him, right?
He has no command authority over them. He recommended it to them.
Okay. Be that as it may, there's no evidence that these officers read the email, right?
No. No, Your Honor.
They testified to it.
No. So the
declaration, my question out, okay? So what we're doing is we're looking at these declarations that don't invoke the email. They just say, in my experience, this is what happens, right? So the email we kind of put aside, right? Is it even relevant?
Well, Your Honor, it's the only...
I mean, the court, I understand the district court, by the way, thought that it was relevant, and I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but I'm just curious, given that these two defendants, there's no testimony that they ever read it. I don't know what we do with it.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so as I said, the focus on the action when you're talking about flight risk is on the action of the detainee themselves. And so what we do with this, I think, is that it's too general. It's too general of a criterion. And because in this circuit and in the United States, generalized criteria are not sufficient to affect even the mildest of stops. You can't stop somebody based on a drug courier profile, for example. The actions of the detainees themselves and the circumstances around them are what justify a seizure. And in this instance, it is undisputed that he has taken no action, none, to warrant or to lead somebody to believe that he was a flight risk.
What's the best case that you're depending upon in this?
Bennett versus City of East Point, Your Honor. And in that case, this court unanimously held that police officers violated the Constitution when they handcuffed unarmed teenagers who made no attempt to flee or did anything else to warrant the use of handcuffs in that instance.
Is there a Supreme Court case on that very subject?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. But there are cases from other circuits. And I think it's pretty interesting to see that in a diversity of factual scenarios, this court's come down the same way. In the absence of any action taken by a detainee themselves to lead an officer to believe that they pose a risk of flight or violence, that the use of handcuffs is unjustified in those circumstances. I believe I'm out of time. If you have no other questions, I will.
You'll have your rebuttal.
Thank you so much.
May it please the court. My name is Rothland King, and I represent Officer Robbins, Officer Lovells, and Sergeant Engstrom. Your Honors, the district court properly concluded that qualified immunity applied in this case and shielded these officers from liability. As Your Honors are aware, the district court never reached the constitutional issue, but rather focused on the second aspect of the qualified immunity analysis, and that was, regardless of whether there was a constitutional violation, was the right that is claimed to be violated clearly established? And the district court answered that question in the negative, Your Honor, and this court should reach the same conclusion. The facts of this encounter make it materially different than any of the cases that Mr. Tarter relies upon.
Why is it materially different than Bennett and Brown? I mean, he's basically compliant for 40 minutes. There is no indication that he's going to run away, and they put handcuffs on him. And I'm just at a loss to figure out why that was necessary in this case.
So, Your Honor, let's look at Bennett, and then I'll look at Brown. First, in Bennett, Your Honor, we have an individual where a group of teenagers are stopped for riding tandem on a bicycle. The law in Michigan was if you rode two people on a bicycle, that was a misdemeanor crime. That's why they were stopped. The court there found that once the teenager dismounted the bicycle, the basis for the stop was over. And under Terry, that should have been the conclusion. But the officers went further. They patted them down. That was the first constitutional violation. Finding no weapons, they then placed them in handcuffs and only threw the African-American individuals in a cruiser. The Sixth Circuit there found that set of remarkable facts, and they said it was remarkable not in a good way, showed a conscious disregard of the most basic Fourth Amendment principles. We segue to Brown, or go backwards to Brown, Your Honor, where there was a lot of confusion over dispatch of who was fleeing the area. But one fact was clear. It was a man that was fleeing in a vehicle. And when the stop was effectuated there was a basis. They said the stop was appropriate. The individual in the car was a woman, and that woman was then met with weapons and was placed in handcuffs and thrown to the ground. The Sixth Circuit said, in that particular case, while the stop was initially appropriate and appropriate under Terry, the basis for that stop was immediately dispelled because it was a woman in the vehicle as compared to a man, and the be on the lookout was for a male suspect, not a woman.
So we strip all that away, though, and we get basically compliant suspects who may have were initially stopped with that in an okay stop, but then were compliant, gave no indication that they were doing anything, were a flight risk, actively resisting, whatever, and they're put in handcuffs, and that's a problem. Why is that not the same thing that happened here?
Your Honor, when we look at the facts of this case, and this is where it's important, because there are multiple steps in this investigation that occurred before the decision was made to place Mr. Tarter in handcuffs. The initial stop was because the card he presented had an inconsistent bank information on it as compared to the bank identification number search. That card was ran multiple times. It was ran initially by the Hertz employee, then by officer levels, then by Sergeant Engstrom. So they were trying to confirm whether that was actually the basis for the stop. The same inconsistent bank information came up three times. They then asked for his driver's license. And when they asked for his driver's license, they ran the DL number, the driver's license number, multiple times, waiting on dispatch to get a positive hit. There was no hit reported by the DMV. This is when they reach out to the off-site detectives. They have two off-site detectives, Lieutenant Scott Harding and Detective Walters. Walters asks for additional credit cards. Tarter voluntarily gives these credit cards, and Walters finds that yet another credit card has inconsistent banking information on it. Now, during this entire interim period of time, they continue, the officers on scene and Walters, go back to dispatch. Do you have a positive identification? Do you have a positive identification? And each time it was reported, no. Then Detective Walters asks for a social security number so a criminal background check could be ran. The number given by Mr. Tarter comes back positive for presenting false identification and other fraud-related claims to law enforcement. It was at this point that when you have two credit cards that had indications of credit card fraud, coupled with no positive identification from Mr. Tarter, a driver's license that shows no hits, no response, nothing, and then an individual that provides a social security number that states positive for criminal similar
right.
activity.
Okay, so they highly suspect that he's a fraudster after 40 minutes of whatever they're doing, all this stuff. Why does that mean you can put him in handcuffs? I still don't get it. What does the handcuffing have to do with any of that? What if it had been 100 credit cards? I don't know.
Your Honor, the testimony and belief of these officers was because when they were going to confront him on the criminal convictions and on the second card, there was a risk that the situation could escalate. And what makes this case markedly different than Bennett and Brown is that this encounter is unfolding in a non-secured public area in a very busy airport. And there had been a history of individuals fleeing, and that was the officer's experience.
But that's not, so the email says I take it to mean when you see the uniformed officers, approaching the counter, not when I say it was Colonel Mustard in the conservatory, and then I pull the card out and I read it to him, and I'm like, oh my God, you got me, and he takes off. Like, those are two different situations, aren't they?
I don't believe they are, Your Honor, because in your scenario, we're still dealing with an individual that may flee. And in this particular case, when you watch the video, when the video is laid out, because almost all of this is caught on CCTV, the officers are moving around freely, and the concern is that once they approach him again and escalate the situation, because the situation is going to escalate.
I don't understand what in the record would reflect that the situation is going to escalate.
And I apologize, Judge Cole, what I mean by escalate is that there's no doubt that Mr. Tarter knows that the initial detention is for the credit card he's handed to the ticket counter representative. Since that time period, Eric Tarter does not know that an additional credit card has been found, that there is no DL positive hit for him as an individual there, and that the Social Security number he provided shows an individual with a history of similar crimes.
Was he ever convicted on these other crimes, or was it just investigated?
I believe the criminal search comes back is that he was arrested for providing false identification to law enforcement.
He was actually arrested for it.
Yes, Your Honor. So at this point, Mr. Tarter does not know these other facts. And at this point, the officers are going to confront him on these other facts. That's why Detective Walters makes the recommendation to Sergeant Engstrom to place the individual in handcuffs, because there is a concern that at this point in the encounter, it is going to change from the initial stop.
But the only evidence in the record about this alleged concern are it's basically the two declarations, is that right? The statements in the declarations that, in my experience, I've investigated similar cases, and in these situations, these suspects flee or tend to flee or whatever. I'm not being precise about the language, and I probably should be, but you know what I'm referring to.
I do, Your Honor. The evidence in this case was the email to all law enforcement with Mr. Tarter acknowledges that all law enforcement received on page 17 of his brief at docket entry.
But we don't know that these two officers had read that email.
And
the email. I mean, surely in their declarations, in their late filed declarations, they could have said, I'm familiar with the email of whatever and was on lookout. And by the way, the email, again, only talks about when you initially approach somebody, really doesn't cover this particular situation, right?
It does not go granular as to this exact fact pattern that during the duration of the encounter. And to answer your prior question, Your Honor, yes, the email, the declarations from these officers, because the other two officers testified about this fact in their deposition. So all three of the officers acknowledge that at some point they are aware that these type of suspects flee. This was a pervasive problem in the airport. That's what brings forth the email that...
Well, they don't say the airport, do they?
The email deals
with the airport, but the declarations say the similar cases or something. It says I've investigated similar cases and these suspects. I mean, it's not very specific. The statements are not very specific.
At the Nashville airport, it would render it very specific because the actual ticket counters before the airport was completely renovated and changed, that was just one ticket counter bank where you would go in and all of the...
Right, but when they say similar cases, I don't know, does that mean similar cases of fraud at the airport? Does that just mean fraud cases? Does that mean I've investigated similar cases? What does that mean?
Like, that would be the case of Mr. Tarter, similar cases of...
Of a person at the airport counter trying to fraudulently rent a Hertz budget, whatever they own now, vehicle.
That's correct, Your Honor. Fraud at the ticket counter.
It's not really set out in the declaration that way, though. Well, I guess you could, I'm hearing you say, well, similar really does mean kind of like on all fours, but.
We are talking about multiple incidents that were happening at the airport. As laid out in the record, this was not the first time that this...
Well, that's in the email, right?
Well, it's also in Lieutenant Scott Harding's deposition testimony, which was in the Statement of Undisputed Facts as well, Your Honor. So this was a pervasive problem at the airport, which multiple steps were being taken to address. And so that was the concern that these officers had. They were relying on their experience that at this moment, the encounter may change, and they were concerned about that unfolding in a public, non-secured place. And that's an important distinction of both Bennett and Brown.
But why doesn't the experience, okay, I understand the experience, I guess, but you also have 42 minutes of compliance. I mean, at some point, the guy knows that he's, I mean, suspected of this, and I don't know, you know, whether he figures whatever he's done, and it turns out he wasn't arrested, so he didn't do anything, right? But, I mean, why doesn't that time, at least with respect to whether it's unconstitutional or not, why doesn't that time just kind of outweigh this whatever this idea is that these suspects can flee sometimes.
And, Your Honor, you hit a very important point on the aspect of constitutionality. Before this court is no decision on the constitutionality of whether the decision itself to place Mr. Tarter in handcuffs was a violation of his rights. The only issue is whether it was a violation of his clearly established rights.
So you're not contesting whether it's constitutional or not?
I'm not stating one way or the other, Your Honor, because that decision was never actually brought to this court.
I mean, you're not making an alternative argument that it was constitutional, and even if it wasn't clearly established?
We maintain it was appropriately constitutional, and I'm happy to address the duration question, but I just wanted to 100% be clear of the record before us, Your Honor. On the duration aspect of this, you do have the 40 minutes which he is being investigated, and there are continuing facts. And in fact, Mr. Tarter never objects, even though it was in his initial complaint, that duration. When it came to summary judgment, he never challenged the duration of the stop. The only thing he challenges now is the decision to place him in handcuffs, a fact not pled in his complaint, but nonetheless, we are here today on it. And in that particular case, Your Honor, we believe it was appropriate and reasonable for these officers to place the handcuffs on Mr. Tarter at that time because the additional facts that had been discovered during that first portion of the encounter. And, Your Honor, to address the second aspect of this, the clearly established standard, Mr. Tarter comes forth with no facts that this is clearly established beyond debate that what these officers did rendered them plainly incompetent or a knowing violation of the law. If the officers were going to look at Bennett versus City of
Houston. Well, I mean, it just comes down to Bennett and
Brown,
right? I mean, if we can, I mean, I don't, you know, the Supreme Court has suggested that we can't even look at our own precedent, but assuming that, I mean, they haven't clearly said, I suppose, by a majority that we can't. So assuming we can, it's Bennett and Brown, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And when you look at what the Supreme Court did in the Wesby case, when we look at Bennett and Brown, the facts have to be particularized. If Bennett and Brown was a fact pattern in which an individual was detained for multiple minutes in a reasonable belief, a good faith Terry stop, in a public space, and there was a decision to use handcuffs subsequently, and it was found that would be a violation.
Yeah, I mean, they've said a couple of different things about generalization.
Correct, Your Honor.
So, I mean, yeah, you got to have something close, but it doesn't have to be on all fours, and I'm just curious whether Bennett and Brown are close enough on what actually matters.
I see that my time expires. May I address your question?
I want to respond to that. Go ahead.
Your Honor, for Bennett and Brown, as we've discussed, the fact patterns are not similar in the sense that those two cases, the Terry stop, while initially valid, became invalid the moment that someone dismounted a bicycle and the moment that a person was recognized to be a woman as compared to a man. Comparatively here, the facts continued to build that there was additional evidence of credit.
So, I mean, it really comes down to whether the fraud aspect, the suspicion of fraud, the building case of fraud, and the fact that you're going to confront him with that in a crowded area, you're saying that distinguishes the case meaningfully from Bennett and Brown. Is
correct.
That right?
Coupled with the officer's experience that these suspects have a tendency.
Okay, great. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. First, I believe it's important to note, since Mr. King spoke at length about the officer's subjective concern that the situation would escalate, that it's also in the record that it's undisputed that neither Officer Lovell nor Sergeant Engstrom ever considered Mr. Tarter to be a flight risk or pose a risk of violence. They were posed these specific questions in their deposition. Did you ever consider Mr. Tarter to be a flight risk? Or did you ever consider him to be dangerous? And they said no. So this subjective risk of escalation that they were concerned about seems to have arisen after the fact and in their late filed declarations. And I think also it's important to note that I believe that Mr. King was misstating what happened in Bennett. In Bennett, the court specifically held that the police had reasonable suspicion to effect a Terry stop because they thought that the teenagers in Terry were casing a store to steal bicycles. And they said that the initial stop was justified. but that the use of handcuffs in the absence of anything that in any attempt to flee or anything else that would warrant that the use of handcuffs in that case was unconstitutional. And so I think you're correct, Judge Nalbandian, when you say to strip away everything else from these cases, what you're left with is a compliant, calm, cooperative suspect who has taken no action to indicate that they, no action, that we're not talking about did he do something that could be reasonably interpreted as a risk of flight. We're not second-guessing a reasonable mistaken belief that an action on the part of Mr. Tarter constituted something that could be considered a flight risk. They subjectively did not consider him a flight risk in this case. And so what we're left with is a calm, cooperative suspect who has done nothing else to indicate anything else than that he was cooperative. And Bennett and Brown and the law of just the general law governing Terry stops and constitutional and seizures say that you need specific facts to do in order to use handcuffs in these situations.
Oh, your client had a credit card that didn't have a matching.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so that
he couldn't rent the car for that.
He actually rented a car from a different rental car counter after the encounter, using that.
These officers didn't.
I don't think so. But Your Honor, I don't think that that's material to the analysis because all that did, and it's undisputed that all it did was give rise to continuing reasonable suspicion to investigate him, and never gave rise to probable cause to arrest him.
Well, if he'd given them a bogus credit card, they'd had a right to investigate, right?
Of course, Your Honor.
If it's somebody had it stolen from.
Of course, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.